You talk in your book about this concept of becoming, that Ellington wants life and music in a constant state of becoming.
Yeah, Clark Terry said that, and I think it really goes to, it explains a lot of things about Ellington. His pieces don't take definitive form. He's not somebody who writes the Fifth Symphony. He writes Mood Indigo, and then he writes another version of Mood Indigo, and then he readjusts it for a new soloist, and maybe 10 years down the line, it metamorphoses into a 10-minute long concert version. He was like this throughout his life, that for him, the making of music was not a creation of fixed points that remain fixed, but it was an ongoing project where pieces develop and evolve, and they never stop evolving. And that really is profoundly true to the whole idea of what jazz is. I mean, what is a jazz composer in an improvised music? And one of Ellington's answers was, a jazz composer is somebody who makes his music new every time he plays it.
Was his first big break at the Cotton Club? And was that success, if that's true, was that success?
A little earlier, but yes. His first big break was that in 1926, he met an up-and-coming song publisher named Irving Mills, who heard him play and said, Mills said to himself, this is the guy I want to work with. And Mills became his manager. And it was Mills who, with others, brought him into the Cotton Club a couple of years later, which got him on national radio and made him a star. But it was Mills who was the genius of publicity and marketing, who figured out how to take this fantastically gifted artist in his band and lift them above the common ruck of all the big bands that were playing in the late 20s and early 30s. It was Mills who had the idea to market Ellington as a man apart, to market him not just as a jazz musician, but as a composer. And that presentation is essential to Ellington's early success. So meeting Mills and then having Mills take him into the Cotton Club, yes, that is the big break. After that, his life is never the same again.
After that, he gets involved with film work. He works on larger works.
That's right. That's right.
He travels. He has lots
of hits. It starts with the Cotton Club. And the Cotton Club, this is very important to understanding why that mattered. The Cotton Club had a national radio wire. So as soon as Ellington went into the Cotton Club, he began broadcasting on CBS and was heard throughout the United States. That's a huge thing for a big band, and especially a black band in the late 20s and early 30s. Suddenly, they're on the big radio network, and people in Podunk can hear them without having to buy their records. Without radio, the other things very likely would not have come, or at least not have come as easily.
And so he was a big influence not only in jazz, but beyond jazz, attracting the attention of other composers and...
Yeah, he's a cultural influence. And he's specifically a racial cultural influence. Because Ellington, working with Mills, but this was his disposition too. Remember that Ellington comes from the black middle class. He sees himself as a kind of an image spokesman, if you see what I mean, for the black race. Beautifully spoken, beautifully dressed. He's not presenting himself as this guy from off the street. He's presenting himself as the kind of black man that maybe in 1929, if you're a white person, you didn't know existed. You know, your ideas about blacks are shaped by racial prejudice. And then suddenly this man, and look, his name is Duke. He comes along and he's a genius, and he's an elegant genius. And you look at him and you listen to him and you scratch your head and maybe you say to yourself, what I thought about blacks, maybe it's not true. The people of his own race, they understood that. They saw him as a great giant, as a great spokesman through his personality and his work for the race, a man who heightened racial pride. And that cultural significance, I won't say it's as important as his musical significance. We remember Ellington because he's a great composer, but we can never forget just how central he is to American culture and black culture throughout much of the 20th century.
And Duke, I understand, was a childhood nickname.
Yes, probably because of the Duke of Wellington. We don't know that for sure, but we do have a lot of accounts of how Ellington, as a young man, would, you know, just kind of style around and show off and dress up fancy. Yet, very possibly, he had a sense of his destiny because his parents adored him, his mother in particular. They believed he was destined for great things. And, you know, if your parents think that about you, there's a good chance that it's going to happen.
And I understand he did not want to call his music jazz.
No, he called it different things at different times. The phrase he used most often probably was Negro folk music. It never stuck. I mean, by the 30s, the term jazz had entered into popular usage. But for Ellington, and for a number of other jazz musicians too, Charles Mingus felt the same way, he saw jazz as a déclassé word. I mean, its etymology is shrouded in the past, but probably has something to do with sex and with the whorehouses that legend incorrectly says are the birthplaces of jazz. And Ellington thought that jazz was serious business, a serious music, destined for concert halls, as he saw himself as destined for Carnegie Hall. And he thought that jazz was an undignified name for this music, which is not to say that there was anything stuffy about his music. It was just that he understood that it was, although an exciting and swinging and funky music, it was ultimately serious art.
He wrote so many songs, and then he wrote musicals. He tried his hand at a lot of larger works that weren't
Yes.
always successful. What do you think his legacy is?
It's going to be the small scale compositions, I think. He didn't do the homework necessary to make a Broadway musical work. I mean, you have to have a different kind of experience that he did not have. And because he didn't have classical training, he didn't really understand in his bones the problem of large scale composition. So his large scale compositions tend to sound stitched together. But he had an absolute mastery of how to put together a piece that lasts anywhere between 3 and 8 minutes, let's say, the length of a 78 side. I call him a disciplined lyric miniaturist. And if you think I'm running him down, then I'm also running down Chopin or Jorge Luis Borges or Paul Klee or any of the other great miniaturists, Flannery O'Connor, the great short story writer. Merely because you work on a small scale does not mean that your work cannot be profound and consequential. Ellington is ultimately a miniaturist, but he's a miniaturist of the highest order. And it's those pieces that write him into the history books, I believe.
Great. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. It's always nice to talk to you.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.